Hey, welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. And today we're going to be talking to Joe Rosenblatt, one of Canada's great poets known around the world. And we're going to ask him about Milton Acorn. There's a new selected poems by Milton Acorn, edited by James Deal. It's titled In a Springtime Instant. And we're going to be talking to Joe. I'm going to call him Joseph Rosenblatt, about Milt and what he thinks of these events and a little bit of history. Later on, we're going to talk to Francis Back, who's a celebrated, highly respected illustrator, book illustrator, the kind that authors hunt down because, you know, a good illustration will sell a book. He's having a dispute with the government of Canada about representations of the War of 1812, and don't we all? And at the end of the show, latter part of the show, we're going to talk to Eve Engler. And Eve Engler is in Montreal, where the greatest student strike in North American history, one of the great student strikes of all time, is unfolding, and it's become a cultural, historical, and broader issue event, as these things will. This is an issue, as they say, that has legs. One of the core questions is the matter of the new economic order and the need for austerity, which, as we all know, we've been told we require, whether we like it or not. And people have talking about closing public schools and et cetera. By the way, Phil Conant is here. How are you doing,
yes,
Phil?
Good afternoon, Phil.
And while we are waiting to reach Mr. Rosenblatt, I have news that I want to share. And it's sad news, but it's also something that we definitely want to remark on. Michael Fellman, a renowned scholar has been written about his death on the 11th of June. David Beers in the Taii, I think it's pronounced, has written a wonderful essay. I recommend you go to that, the Taii, .ca, and Taii is spelled T-Y-E-E .ca, whether I pronounced it correctly or not. And David Beers has written there about Michael Fellman and just a line from Michael Fellman, apropos of all our discussions today. He says, militarism is seeping into Canadian ideological and institutional life with highly dangerous short-term and long-term implications. And then Beers goes on to elaborate on the work of Michael Fellman. Anyway, it's a sad loss, and we will be returning to that subject in future programs. But I think we're joined now by Joseph Rosenblatt. Are you there, sir?
I am, Phil.
Hey, it's nice to be talking to you, Joe. Thanks very much. You have a great career. I want to remind everybody, as a poet and an artist and an editor, and people can find the selected poems under the title Topsoil. You were the Governor General's Award winner, and you wrote, a fascinating, wonderful title, a prose memoir, Escape from the Glue Factory, a memoir of a paranormal Toronto childhood in the late 40s. I noticed you went to Central Tech, which would make it, you know, paranormal. Paranormal's a natural connection.
Well, I probably was the first dropout in Ontario in 1950.
Wow.
Well,
you're going to give heart to all the dropouts, I know.
Oh, I'm sure.
And you know that there's this, of course, we want to talk to you today because there's a new edition of a book, selected poems by an old friend of yours and a peer and a great artist, Milton Acorn. It's titled In a Springtime Instant. And I know you are a great believer in the work of Milton. Could you want to talk about how important it is that these kind of books that Milton be put out in a new edition?
Well, it's very important because Milton was one of the great poets in the in the last century, if you want to put it. Mm-hmm. He was a romantic poet. I probably disagree with James Deal, that he was a political poet. He was a poet hooked, addicted to tough love. And he wrote poems about love, nature, and the environment. He worshipped a elephant, a cosmic elephant.
Yeah.
You know.
Yes, I remember he said that the heart of the elephant had a heart.
I must tell you, I had fun with that. Yeah. You know, I wrote about it, his elephant poem, The Natural History of Elephants. Mm-hmm. And it's a long, epic poem, and it's a very thunderous and voluble poem.
Mm-hmm.
And he was of that stuff, you know.
Yes.
And he was politically incorrect back in the 60s. He had some quirky ideas, you know.
It's a rare poet that doesn't, would you agree?
Well, I'd say yes and no. But with Milton, he's kind of a larger-than-life individual, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He influenced me considerably. His then wife back in the, you know, in the 60s, he subsequently broke away. His marriage broke up with Gwendolyn McEwen. But her cosmic and spiritual poems influenced me more than Milton's proletarian outlook and outlook on life, mm-hmm. you know. And so I was like a person tossed between two parents, you know, in a kind of separation disagreement. And so I may have disappointed Milton in that I didn't become a worker poet, you know. And I probably disappointed Al Purdy as well, who was Milton's friend.
Mm-hmm. And we have a nice statue, by the way, of Purdy now in Queens Park.
Yeah, I know.
It's amazing to see that, isn't it?
What?
Isn't it amazing to look at a guy and you say, oh, I remember it.
Well, yeah, and I think there should have been a poem of his at the front of the statue. He's simply a poet. Well, I won't argue about that.
I'll bet you win that point, by the way. All admirers of Purdy would like to see some of that on the stone.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, you go to Allen Gardens, there's Robbie Burns with poems on both sides of the statue. You know, the base of the statue. And, by the way, it's where Allen Gardens free speech poetry situation took place.
Mm-hmm.
Could you, in front of that statue.
Could you talk about that? Because on the 12th of July, they're going to go there at 4 in the afternoon, and I think they intend to read some poems. They're going to gather at the Burns statue. What happened? Talk about the Allen Gardens free speech.
It all started in 1962 with some members of the Bohemian Embassy Club, you know, which was then thriving. You know, it followed the San Francisco style coffee house movement. And we decided, a few of us decided to go down and read first at the circle where the statue of Purdy is, you know, Queens mm-hmm. Park Circle.
Uh-huh.
And that was in very late April. And then we decided, on a whim, I guess, to go to Allen Gardens. Well, the first time we got away with reading, no cops busted up our reading, but then we started reading in Allen Gardens. And we soon realized that you had to, poets were refused free speech. Only Sunday preachers were allowed to speak there, right?
Yeah.
So what happened was very strange. I mean, we didn't know that. We were quite naive. Then we started to get some heat from the cops who said, well, they first were very nice and very polite and said, well, you can't speak here. And we said, well, how strange, you know.
Yes.
And we, Milton, of course, being very boisterous, decided to take the lead, which he did. And I was kind of on the sidelines because at that time I had a job working for the old CPR and I couldn't afford to get in the news. I'd lose my job.
Yeah.
So
Milton decided to get you a
no job and lived on his pension, his war pension, decided he to read. And so he read, I Shout Love. Well, that certainly got the attention of the Toronto police because
Love will do it every time.
They issued a summons to him. And after that, the news broke out, the Star and the then Telegram and the Globe got in on the act. They basically supported our right to free speech in Allen Gardens. Although I must tell you, I think it was the Sun had nasty caricatures of poets. They were called beatniks. They had crazy hair,
yeah.
Right?
You had to have crazy hair.
And they were, you know, I mean, it was grotesque.
Yeah.
And here I was with a job. I didn't look anything like that. So, and neither did a lot of other people there.
Yeah.
You know, and it got bigger and bigger, and the Milton kept getting summonses, which he collected.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, the news got out, and there were hundreds of people there.
Wow.
And I would say thousands. And they came out, and I can remember John Douglas, one of the people at the Bohemian Embassy. He started reading Allen Ginsberg's Howl in front of the greenhouse. So, you know, I got worried that maybe the plants would be stomped upon, you know,
yeah.
some issue of public order was involved, especially when the crowd became really incensed that we were being denied the right to read poetry.
Amazing.
And they surged forward in hundreds. And I thought there would be a riot. And I calmly stepped forward and I told the people to relax and we would go by the orders. We would cease for now. At that time, we would come back the following Sunday, which we did. And by then, of course, the crowds got bigger and bigger. And we needed a civil rights lawyer. So we got Irving Himmel, who was then, I believe, if memory serves me, a Queen's counselor. And he got in on our case for free, you know, and he provided services for the Toronto poets. You have to remember that in the 30s, the communists tried to hold rallies in the Toronto parks, and they were denied that right. There were riots.
Yep.
I thought, isn't this wonderful that poets could open up a gateway of freedom?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
and which we did.
And Milt was a great platform reader, wasn't he?
Milton, yes, he was. Quite a performer. He was at his height, you know, producing wonderful poetry. It was a very interesting, monumental point in his life. He was, you know, being recognized as a serious poet. Mm-hmm. But anyway, to cut to the chase, what happened in 1964, we actually won. What happened was the city council adopted the New York City bylaws, which meant that you could apply for a permit, which was, at least we, when you applied for the permit, you were allowed to, you know, do what you wanted to as far as free speech went. And so we won the right of free speech, although with conditions.
Yeah, they never give you a pure win, do they?
Well, it was better than a no win, of course.
Absolutely. Are you kidding? It was a great one, and it's a great story. We're speaking to Joseph Rosenblatt, one of our great poets and known around the world, and he's also an artist, by the way. And something else I want to ask you, Joe, about that moment, and it sure hit everybody in Canada heard about the time when Milton published the I've Tasted My Blood, and everybody said, wow, that is a great book of poems. And it didn't win the prize and got transformed into a label which he must have relished to his dying day, which was the People's Poet.
Yes.
Can you talk about that?
And Eli Mandel, when he was alive, organized the event, okay, at Grossman's Tavern. And Irving Layton also kicked in money. I believe Leonard Cohen kicked in money. And the PEI government kicked in money. So there was a medal and a cash check, $1,000, presented to
Milton. For a poet, that's great stuff.
At Grossman's Tavern. And it was a fun event. A lot of people came to it. And Mr. Mirvish, he was then alive and very generously was there.
A
tuxedo, would you believe? And the very, very people that Milton would not have given the time of day to, the bourgeoisie, so to speak, were there to honor him.
Yeah.
Which was
whether
crazy.
He wanted it or not.
Yes. Well, there you go. So he got a check. He didn't get the governor general's, true enough, but he certainly appreciated the love and the support and the money that was available. It was a cash check, so I had to be doubly sure that Milton put it in the bank.
Yeah, he had
so there you go.
Yeah, oh, that's a great story.
Yeah,
And of course, he came back, and they realized they'd embarrassed themselves. Later, they did give him an award.
Well, yes,
but that
you
was
know,
embarrassed themselves the second time.
Happens, so you know, you take it with a grain of salt, really. You know, another point I want to make is that in 1970, the War Measures Act came into being, right? It was when police, the army occupied Montreal, and there was a case given by Trudeau that he had to apply the War Measures Act because he had to apprehend an insurrection, a revolution.
Amazing.
Well, Milton and I felt horrified, and we were filled with revulsion that something like that would take place, and they were throwing just about anyone, left, right of center, so forth, labor leaders, mm-hmm. went to jail.
Mm-hmm.
And so Milton got me to write a poem. It was called the Cockroach Poem for the War Measures Act, which was published in the Varsity with Milton's encouragement.
Uh-huh.
And would you believe, at the time I was living on College and Grace, and on the third floor with my wife, and what happened was that someone came around and asked the person on the ground floor, a storekeeper, who the nice people were on the third floor. So that kind of told me that there's always the danger of a police state, you know.
Absolutely.
At any time in Canada, you know. So,
well, that's a great...
that was a wake-up call for me and certainly for Milton.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great story, Joe. By the way, we are all gonna hunt that poem up, and we're either gonna make you read it or we're gonna read it.
<That's> I'm trying to forget about it.
Yeah, well, so. I'm sure you should be proud of it. And
I
bet Milt was proud of him. Milt was proud of him. Hey, Joseph, thanks very much. It's great talking to you.
You're most welcome, Bill.
All right, thank you.
Glad to be on your program.
Glad to talk to you. Okay, talk to you soon.
Take care.
Bye-bye. That's Joseph Rosenblatt, and he's one of the most distinguished poets of Canada and known around the world. And he's a great, of course, he's also an artist, and his collected works are, everybody should have a copy of it. And again, now the book is Milton Acorn. In a Springtime Instance. It's a selected poems. It's edited by James Deal. There's going to be a book launch at the Parliament Library at, I think, at 6 or 6:30. That's close enough. And it's, by the way, it's Mosaic Press, and it'll be July the 12th. And at 4 o'clock, there's going to be a gathering at the Burns statue we suspect there'll be readings of poems. And we don't know if it'll be as exciting as it was the time that Joe Rosenblatt and Milton Acorn almost started a riot trying to read poems. Anyhow, so we hope people will attend that and get. And it's a. I have to tell you, I love the cover because Milton was a good friend, and just looking at it is poignant for me. And so we were going to. We'll be reminding you of that, and I'll remind you now that at about 5 minutes or so, we're going to be speaking to Francis Back, and he is in Montreal. Francis Back is a distinguished illustrator, historical and children's books, and he, we know, is very careful in his work. He's an artist, just as we were talking about Milton Acorn and Joseph Rosenblatt, they care a lot about their integrity and what they do. And so Mr. Back has had a problem with people wanting him to do 1812 work according to what you might call a formula. He's having a little problem with the formula. And speaking of formula, I was watching a British historian talk about this matter of the War of 1812, which we're being told about. By the way, you could just... put your fingers in your ears. You're not being told a thing about the War of 1812, so just relax. It's impossible. If you were to listen to the CBC and the way they present it, well, you know, you're just wasting your time. You may as well be in a garden. Nothing to do with history. It's a little caricature. But I was reading one of the silliest people, Mitch Potter in the Toronto Star about 5 or 6 days ago, and he was down in Baltimore where one of the battles of the War of 1812 happened. And he found himself a fellow columnist, I discovered, a guy who writes for the Washington Post, I think, or Washington Times, I'm not sure which. And they were talking about something rather close to my heart, a song by sung by Johnny Horton called The Battle of New Orleans. And when I was watching, I'll go back to the British historian was talking about this, and he said, you know, I was a young student in England, and He said, one morning I woke up and I heard a song, and he said, I really liked the song. And he says, now, of course, I'm British. I was listening, and he said, I thought the Battle of New Orleans, what is he talking about? He said, of course, the British don't know anything about the War of 1812, because people, it's a conceit here to say, we know, but the Americans are ashamed. Actually, the main player, as Rick Salutin said in the, I think the same issue of Toronto Star, was the main player is the British Empire. It was an empire, and it was kind of busy in 1812. If you've heard of the 1812 overture, they were very busy. And so they don't actually discuss it much. So he said he listened to the song, and later, of course, in his work as an historian, he said he came to find that the song was accurate, which is rare with popular songs. But Mitch Potter had talked to a guy who told him it's wrong in every detail. And you can believe the following sentence. He said, Andrew Jackson wasn't there. Andrew Jackson was in Alabama, and he quoted the man. You know, I know 10-year-olds who could take, well, I mean, anybody could go to Wikipedia. Just go take a look. It was, Andrew Jackson was present. There was a very famous British general who was there, Pakenham, and he was the brother-in-law of the Iron Duke, Duke of Wellington, and he lost a good portion of his troops, and he himself was shot dead, together with his second-in-command, also shot dead. Why the people get silly about this? It's just one battle, and it's a peculiar one, but try to engage in debunking and to target of all people, Johnny Horton, who's only, the guy singing. The clincher on this is, that it makes it interesting to me, is that it was originally written by a Southern high school teacher who wanted his students to listen to his point about American history, so he made up the song, and then it became famous. At any rate, I thought Rick Salutin made the best observation about the War of 1812 when he pointed out, and I think our guest coming up is going to probably have similar ideas, but this was a war engaged in by the British Empire and the Americans, who at that point were upstarts. But you have to remember to use the word empire, because going on in Europe was a battle of empires, and I haven't seen anybody here remark on the issues, because if you say, well, we were involved, which is kind of presumptuous since Canada was not at that time involved, but you have to say what you believed in. At the time, there was the issue of neutral shipping, something which the Americans are dead against today. The United States now is in a British position. They want to deny movement of other people's vessels. They want to determine whether you can trade with somebody, and they will use their power in international waters, an exact replica of what the British were doing. So if you favor that sort of thing, then I say you believe in empires. But if the dispute, if at its core, that's what it was about. The issue, they were having a battle to the finish with Napoleon. And as typical of these things, it was settled by the Russians and not by the British. But they were having that dispute. And this upstart country insisted that it had the right to trade with the European states, non-belligerent. But they were told, no, you can't do that. And on top of that, sailors were taken off ships. Someone ought to ask the Americans, are you sure you're fully grown now? Because, you know, they used to, they allowed the British to remove 6,000 sailors from their commercial vessels, 6,000 to be impressed into the British Navy. Today, you know, they're ready to go to war with you over a missing civilian or whatever. But at that time, they stood by and allowed this to happen. And the guy who failed them in that regard was Thomas Jefferson, who in his years as president, he talked big about fighting. He never fought. Matter of fact, he got rid of the Navy, got rid of the Army, and he was pretty easy pickings. It would have been had the British wanted to take him on. Anyway, I think we're getting there. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back and talk to Francis Back.
From the roots up, CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto, presenting the history and evolution of sound for 25 years and counting. CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
And we're back, and it's the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. Phil, you have an announcement about your program tomorrow.
Yes, well, tomorrow on Classical Underground, we are going to celebrate a few days early La Fête Nationale, Jean-Baptiste Day. We're going to play some music where some opera excerpts where John the Baptist appears. We're going to play another opera excerpt where John the Baptist's day is celebrated with a pillow fight. But most importantly, we're going to interview Mimi Blay, a Quebec pianist who is single-handedly reviving ragtime in Quebec and reviving the music of Jean-Baptiste Lafreniere, who was a ragtime composer at the turn of the 20th century in Montreal and had ragtime cafes until the church shut him down. It's a great, very interesting story. So we're going to be talking to Mimi and playing the music of Jean-Baptiste Lafreniere, which is, I've never heard it on the radio, so this may be a first.
Uh-huh. So at what time?
At 12 noon tomorrow, Tuesday, between 12 and 2.
Okay, 12 tomorrow. I know, that's very interesting. But we're still trying to reach Francis back, and I will remind you again about the July 12, the book launch of the new edition of Milton Acorn in a springtime instant, and that's going to be at the Parliament Library. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon at the Allen Gardens at the statue of Tommy Burns, they're going to be talking I guess probably a few speeches. They're going to read poems, I assume. By the way, you remember Milt, I'm sure, Phil.
Very well, very well.
Milt was a platform moment. That sort of thing cannot be reproduced. You had to see that. I think we are joined now by the historical illustrator Francis Back. Are you there, sir?
Yes, I am.
Hey, Mr. Back, thank you very much for joining us. We've been inundated in recent days by so much about the War of 1812, and we're all being told we have to learn the lessons, and we have to emphasize certain events, and a narrative is being unfolded for us. I won't attempt to characterize it, but I know that you, working as an illustrator, had some difference with the way the government is sort of setting out this campaign, and there was an article in the Devoir discussing your views. Can you tell us what is your objection to the way the Harper government is portraying the story of 1812?
Well, in fact, it's true. I'm an illustrator, but I have a specialty, the historical illustrator. I even had my first commission when I was just 16, starting to do postcards for a historical museum. And over the years, I did over 30 years of research in archives and things like that. So I work for Asia, United States, or Europe, mm-hmm. or historical commission, and most of the time people come to me because they know that I have a certain kind of knowledge about history. So mm-hmm. I'm not just somebody who draw. I'm also somebody many times who bring new ideas and even new documentation to specialists. I know it sounds a bit like I'm not a star, but it's true, it's a specialty in the field of illustration. You have many fields. Mm-hmm. One of them is historical illustrators. So mm-hmm. Many times I'm commissioned by it's the A Fever now in Montreal, so mm-hmm. I have a sticking. But in a way, I work. I start to work in three ways about this War of 1812 Harper project, and slowly I start to disagree about the way they saw this event.
Mm-hmm. This is Francis Back. By the way, your work is, I want to just say, as someone who's been doing my research, it's beautiful work, and It is clear that you are concerned about getting the details of these matters right. Was there something, an issue to do with the historical figure Tecumseh? Did I understand that you, for example, submitted something that was not accepted?
Yeah, it happened a few times. But in the past, you know, sometimes it's... what afraid me is a bit... I'm a visual communicator. I'm somebody between historians and the public. And sometimes I could disagree with the subject people propose me. Sometimes it's because I don't feel there is documentation enough. That's, I think, my scientific part. Once I was offered by an American publisher to make a city, African city of the Middle Age, and I say I know myself so much little about it, so I refuse the subject. But I could also refuse the subject because I feel the commission is the message behind the drawing is wrong and historically not accurate and as a kind of ethic, you know, I must do something accurate and as right as I think. And I just hope as an artist it will be nice also to look, but that people could learn. But if the message is wrong, then I could also refuse to do it, you know. It's not a money issue. It's not a historical issue. It's more ethic issue. Mm-hmm. And for me, the War of 1812, what hurt me with the approach of the government now is that, first, a government could choose to commemorate every year many different historical moments in our history. Now the upper government chose to commemorate the Battle of Vimy. Mm-hmm. In fact, that was fought in 1917, where in fact the Canadians were fighting again a colonial war, those many thousand soldiers to conquest a small hill in France. That's a choice. So they chose, they cut in archivists, archaeologists, things, but they could found suddenly the money to found 5,000 young Canadians to go to France, pay them a flight for a war. In fact, we were forced to do. The second choice of the government Harper was to close the house of Wyriel. Wyriel was the Métis leader. He was killed, and the house where his body was shown and where he lived part of his life that belongs to Parks Canada was closed this year. So it's very strange choice again. And the third choice is to choose the War of 1812. Again, Canadians didn't choose. It's because of challenging English-British ships were seizing American ships that we were forced to fight. And the big loser of this war were the native people.
Hmm. Yeah. By the way, I'm very struck by that because there seems to be an uneasiness about what to say about this figure, Tecumseh, who the British drew him into an alliance which was very fateful for the native people of the Ohio Valley. I mean, all that territory was lost, and everybody talks about victories. I mean, it seems to be impossible.
Yeah, that's the natives were the big loser of this war, and this is I had the chance to work in the past with many native communities. I'm not native myself. I have just a few drops of native blood, thanks to my mother, but. By working with native communities, I became very sensible about their past, and I start to worry a lot about their future. You know, I'm French-Canadian, for example. Mm-hmm. We could say, what is the future of the French language in Canada? But what I worry more is the disappearance of native language in Canada. and I worked with some community where no more elder could speak the original language. So, in fact, yeah, this war, I disagree about the vision for two main reasons. We could celebrate a war to make a moment of, a step, and thinking more about the philosophy, all the bad side of a war who make just dead or wounded people and many widows and homeless children, you know. Mm-hmm. I think war must be commemorated in a human way, not as to glorify our soldiers, more as a moment of reflection about the stupidity of human aggressivity.
Mm-hmm. I absolutely agree with you. I think many voices are, you know, trying to be raised. It's at a time when once a government begins to put down money and say, we want you to hold an event and fire off some cannons and have a man give a speech, it's usually a pretty unhappy result.
But usually it's fake moment. I'm really sad about is, in fact, I'm a freelance historical illustrator, and what has surprised me is after my paper in Le Devoir, many historians or archaeologists or people involved in their historical field phone me or send me private emails saying, thanks, Francis, to say what we feel wrong. And I ask them, but why? It's my, it's not my role to do it. Mm-hmm. I think historians as citizens must also criticize the way you commemorate a country, and this war is not true. It doesn't make Canada united. Mm-hmm. It was a challenge. Many Canadians died for a reason they were not even, really involved with, and we fight under the Union Jack because we have no choice. But and the native people were the big loser. They lose most of their land west of the Great Lakes.
Yes.
So I don't know in which way you could choose that to be to create cheer up events. For me, it will be more a moment of reflection and even a moment of sorrow for the first inhabitant of this continent, and in this way, after I start to work on tree project, and I say I feel it's wrong the way you view this historical event. When I felt it was we know we are wrong, but that's the message we want to give.
Mm-hmm.
Me as an historical illustrator, I couldn't have no pleasure to make paintings depicting something I feel wrong. I refuse to do it.
Well, I'd like to join all those people who said thank you for having spoken up, and I think you're going to give heart to others. Listening to you, I'm really hoping that some of our authors will step forward with books along the themes you outline, and that they ask you to illustrate them. That would be my idea of the best thing that could happen.
This idea is shared by many people. What I'm surprised of is I'm not basically an historian, and I would love that people involved teaching in university and everything could say to the government, when you decide to make an historical event, could you at least be honest in the kind of message you want to give? Yeah. That, I think, is the best gift we could give to every citizen and the kids. Kids need to know what it was in the past, and I hope more people will talk, you know. What afraid me is too many people are silent now. I don't know why.
Yeah. Well, that's a great point. We have to close with that. Francis Back, it's been a pleasure talking to you. You sound fine. I was afraid you were going to be very ill today, but you sound good.
Okay, bye. It was my pleasure.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Francis Back. And by the way, his illustrations are great. I urge you just simply Google his name, because he is quite a well-known and respected illustrator. And his works are very, very touching. And apropos of what he said, I have a quote from Michael Fellman, who has passed away at the age of 69. And there's a great obituary written by his friend David Beers. You can get it at thetyee.ca. And here's the quote from Michael Fellman. Truly engaged history writing is anarchic, or at least irreverent. It challenges authority. It is the assertion of freedom of thought against the constraints of received wisdom. It is the individual declaration that one need not be neutralized by the powerful fear of being isolated or derided, that one can find one's own voice. And that's Michael Fellman, who was a great historian and a great opponent of war, and that's why, as a matter of fact, he lived in Vancouver. And we're joined by somebody else who's a great historian and an opponent of war. Eve Engler, are you there, Eve?
Hey, how's it going, Phil?
Yeah. By the way, did you know Michael Fellman? Hear about this? He'd written a number of books. I thought you might have run into him, but just passed away. But you have a great book. I want to make sure we tell people before we ask you some questions, by a book about Lester Pearson, where it's the peacemaker is saying the truth may hurt. Now you're engaged at the moment in pretty exciting affairs. You are in Montreal, and you are in and around you is one of the great student strikes in modern history. What stage are we at with this?
Well, it's more than 4 months long. We still have, I think we're into 56th day of night demonstrations in a row. So there's a demonstration leaving every night. For a period, there were actions in neighborhoods all across the city and the province every day, too. That has subsided, but there is still night demonstrations every day, and there's a plan for a major mobilization on Friday. This last weekend, there were a number of night demonstrations, including one that was tied into a concert where I don't know, as many as 100,000 people were at the concert, which was a very political concert by a group called the Loco Locas, which is a rap group that's very political, has a song called Liberate Us from the Liberals. That's their popular anthem. And all the student leaders ended the concert off coming on stage and sang that song.
How big was that event? How many people would have been there?
They say as many as 100,000 people. Yeah. I actually wasn't at the thing. I've seen some video footage from it. But
you may have been there and not known it. That's big.
Yes, yeah, no, I walked by, and all that was possible was to watch the concert on a screen a block away from where the concert was actually happening. So, but then that morphed into a demonstration that I marched in for a while, a couple thousand people at 11, after 11 o'clock at night on Friday night. So it's still going strong. It's, you know, really unbelievable to obviously imagine 4 months later. But the fact that, you know, after everything and after levels of political repression, and not just last weekend, the weekend before was a whole new level of political repression, a whole new level of political profiling. There was the Grand Prix weekend, and the police admitted that they just put over 30 people in preventative detention for just happening to go on the metro in the direction of where the Grand Prix was taking, and because they had red squares on. There's all these reports. Little 5-year-old kid who had he was with his father, went out to the park where the race is at, and the cops took his bag, searched it, found a Guy Fawkes mask in his bag, took the mask. This woman who was detained, who was going out for a picnic at this park, and happened to, when she got out of the metro, the Parchant Drapeau, she talked to somebody who had a red square on, asked them a question. The cops assumed that she was there for a potential protester, and they detained her for multiple hours. She had a pretty serious medical issue going into it, led to her throwing up four occasions, and the cops wouldn't take her handcuffs off until after the second time she threw up. These are just stories making it into La Presse, into Le Devoir. Story after story of tourists who just happened to be on the street who were attacked. And that's the logic. When you give the cops basically a blank check, which is what the province has done, financially speaking, a blank check in terms of, a new law that allows them to go, even further, and you create a whole political climate where, for instance, the Minister of Culture referred to the Red Square as being a symbol of violence. This was after a prominent Quebecois artist refused their nomination to the Order of Quebec in light of the student strike and all that's going on. And the minister's response was to say the Red Square is a symbol of violence, which prompted thousands and thousands, and it was 2,600 Quebecois artists to write a letter denouncing the minister. Finally, the minister, after a couple of days, finally did ultimately apologize. But they've created a whole climate where the police just see anyone wearing red square as a threat, as a danger, and as somebody to be mistreated, which is largely a reaction to the success, of course, of the mobilization for the past multiple months.
It is so remarkable. This is Eve Engler, and he's the author of Lester Pearson Peacekeeping, the True Truth May Hurt. The issue seems to be a government that thinks that it has the police, and the police have the people. It's not they seem to have it upside down as to who serves whom. They're getting a broad reaction. What everybody's remarking on here is that this is just not something seen elsewhere, that a population crosses cultural class lines and behaves and reacts the way they do. I mean, particularly with the Casero phenomenon, nobody's ever seen that here.
No, I think in terms of from a North American context, there's no doubt that it's right at the forefront of the resistance to neoliberal capitalism, and I think that's part of why the dominant media and political elites across, not just in Quebec but across the country, are so hostile to the movement, as they understand rightly that it is a threat to the agenda that they've been pushing, and the part of the success of the agenda is the idea that there is no alternative and there's nothing you can do, and you just have to accept less pension, you have to just accept higher tuition, you have to accept more privatization, etc. And so, but you really do see when there is a successful resistance that put forward, you do see the tendencies, if you would like to call it, sort of fascistic tendencies of the political elites that come out in those contexts when there is a real success. So, there's these stories about the different universities and how much money, there's reports on how much money they've been spending on security. So UQAM spent $850,000 over about a three-month period in extra security. McGill spent $214,000 on extra security to protect one simple building, because that building had been occupied in November. So it just, this is the issue is supposed to be about finding money from public to increase tuition to help out the taxpayer, but when it comes to a question of spending money on repression, the government can spend endlessly, and they've said that very clearly to the Montreal police, that they have a blank check to spend as much as they want on policing the demonstrations.
That is very revealing, I guess, would be the best way to put it. Now they're going to be they have a sort of a calendar thing, right? That they do something on the 22nd. They have so far. It's sort of the date. Is something what's going to happen on June 22nd?
So June 22nd is the mass demonstration that all the different student federations are promoting, and it's become the date. March 22nd was the first massive demonstration that was something like 200,000, and then April 22nd was a massive demonstration, but it was that was tied into Earth Day, but it took on a sort of added flavor with all that was going on. And then, of course, May 22nd was as many as 500,000. Incredible. That was a civil disobedience. And the plan is for another massive demonstration on Friday. I would guess personally that it will be smaller than the previous 22nd demonstration, just because all the schools are out. All kinds of different dynamics.
Quebec, it's traditional in Montreal. People disappear in the summer, right?
Exactly. People disappear in the summer. There is a very different kind of feel to the city. So it will probably be smaller, but I still expect there will be, tens and tens of thousands.
Great sentence? It'll be smaller. It'll just be tens of tens of thousands.
I said this about the 50th anniversary, the 50th demo night demo in a row. There was about 300 people in the rain. And I was saying, and it's just some of the papers were presenting, oh, it's really getting smaller and it's dying down. And I was like, I've spent, over a month of my time mobilizing for a demonstration where we were, hoping to get 250, 300 people. And now this is just the 50th of a day after day affair on a bad night, and there's 300 people. Once people that's part of what happens. Once people get mobilized, that's what you saw with the with Formula One.
They like it, don't they? They feel good.
It feels good, and people start seeing other issues. There's lots of issues that people are, not happy about, but they just sort of, I don't agree with that, but I just stay quiet. But once people start getting mobilized, then they start, an issue like the Formula One, and they start becoming, active, not just sort of passively opposed, but more sort of actively opposed. And that ultimately is what's, so threatening. It's not just a question of the tuition, which obviously the government wants to, increase in the neoliberal, but it's also just a mobilized population starts, asking questions and making demands in other areas beyond. And that's, I think, what you're already seeing and is going to be seen certainly over the coming years, if not decades, really, from what's taken place over the past few months.
Yeah. Well, Eve, it's great talking to you about all this. Congratulations again on your terrific book, Pearson, Peacekeeping, The Truth May Hurt. We're going to keep following this, but every 22nd, we're going to have to make sure we know from you what's going on. We really appreciate it. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. Eve Engler. And getting close to the wind-up, we have, on July 12th, there will be the book launch Parliament Library, and there will be for Milton Acorn, Springtime Instant, and at 4 o'clock, that's on the 12th, they're going to gather at the Tommy Burns statue. And as Joe Rosenblatt pointed out, on this Tommy Burns statue, they have Tommy Burns poetry. And they ought to do the same with Al Purdy. Shouldn't just say, poet. Yeah, I got that. Put some poetry on that rock. Thanks to Carol. Thanks to Phil Conlon. And I'm Phil Taylor for the Taylor Report. And we'll see you again.